And I would like to join with Andrew in welcoming you very warmly indeed to St. Helens this evening. If this is your first visit with us, then I hope it will be the first of many, and I do hope we'll see you again, and I hope you enjoy the evening. I want to introduce us now, if I may, to the first in this series of talks entitled The Signs of Our Times. And this evening what I want to do is introduce us to the big question of the series, if you like. And we'll find it if you pick up these Matthew's Gospels and take hold of one of those and turn to page 43, you'll find it posed there by Jesus Christ. Page 43, chapter 16, and then it's over in the right-hand column, and verse 15 there, as Jesus turns to those who've been following him and says to them, "What about you? Who do you say that I am?" Let me say straight away that it is a personal question, that it's not simply an academic question. And the answers that one comes up with to that question ought to have powerful and profound implications for the priorities of our lives. Across the continents, through the centuries, Jesus has challenged and changed, inspired and influenced. We can see his imprint on the architecture and the literature, on the philanthropy and the artistry, on the devotion and on the imagination of whole cultures. But the question of this evening, and indeed of this week, is personal. It's there. What about you? Who do you say that I am? I wonder if we were to take one of those, what the media called, you know, a vox pop with a microphone and head off around the offices and the business houses that surround us. I wonder what adjectives might be used to describe Jesus Christ. Some no doubt would say he's interesting but irrelevant. A fascinating figure of history, but a figure who is predominantly incredible and therefore essentially irrelevant for today, a kind of pale Galilean, a shadowy figure. That's the way Federico Fellini presented him in the film, wasn't it? He is a pale Galilean, worth studying for academic reasons, but an essentially shadowy figure, interesting but irrelevant. Others might describe him, I guess, as impotent, innocuous, but strangely soothing and comforting. I think that's, the sort of Jesus, the emotional equivalent to Calpol for grown-ups, you know? Jesus is the kind of psychological Disprin or the adult comfort blanket. I think that's the way that Jesus is really presented in Dawn French's Vicar of Dibley, isn't it? You know, she has a picture of Jesus on the wall. She conducts her life with little or no reference to him at all. She doesn't really believe in him as God's unique living son and lord and king. But in extremis, when she's really up against it, you know, as she passes the picture on the wall, well, she'll pour her heart out to him and tell him her problems and expect him to sort them out. That's his job after all. Jesus, the comfort blanket. For others in our culture, I think Jesus has become recently something of a fashion accessory. It's actually quite trendy to be spiritual these days. When you glance at other people's copies of Hello magazine, you will see that it's quite in fashion. Some people go for their therapy to the Priory. That really is a fashion accessory, isn't it? Others do Eastern religion with yoga and a guru from Balham. But I do the Jesus thing. Jesus, the fashion accessory. I wonder, you know, if we were to come round the tables, I mean, we're not going to do this, let me assure you, we're not into this sort of thing, but if I were to come round the tables, what adjectives or nouns would you use of Jesus Christ? Who do you say he is? That's the subject for our week of talks, and the method of our investigation is really very, very simple. I have, I think, a very simple job over this week, because we're going to go to the eyewitness accounts of the life of Jesus, and we're just going to look at them. And I'm going to point us to what Jesus calls the signs of the times, that is, what he said, what he did, how he lived, And then I'm going to ask you to think, and to think of what you make of it and who you believe he is, who you think he is, on the basis of the eyewitness evidence. So, as I say, that's our method. And let me say that I will encourage you before the end to look at this Christianity Explored course that we run here. I'll ask you to pick that up later, because I feel in one evening to come to a firm conclusion as to who I believe Jesus is quite a short glance at the evidence. But now Debbie Heaney is going to read for us, and Debbie is going to read two of the signs of the times. They are miracles of Jesus, which the Old Testament told us to expect him to do, and they deliberately identify Jesus as God's Son sent by God. So if you turn then back a couple of pages to page 37, Debbie is going to read from chapter 14 and verse 13. Is it, Debbie? Thank you very much.
We're on page 37, and we're starting to read at verse 13, which is about two-thirds of the way down that page. When Jesus heard the news about John, he left there in a boat and went to a lonely place by himself. The people heard about it, so they left their towns and followed him by land. Jesus got out of the boat, and when he saw the large crowd, his heart was filled with pity for them, and he healed those who were ill. That evening his disciples came to him and said, "It is already very late, and this is a lonely place. Send the people away, and let them go to the villages to buy food for themselves." "They don't have to leave," answered Jesus. "You yourselves give them something to eat." "All we have here are 5 loaves and 2 fish, they replied. "Then bring them here to me," Jesus said. He ordered the people to sit down on the grass. Then he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, looked up to heaven and gave thanks to God. He broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the people. Everyone ate and had enough. Then the disciples took up 12 baskets full of what was left over. The number of men who ate was about 5,000, not counting the women and children. Then Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side of the lake while he sent the people away. After sending the people away, he went up a hill by himself to pray. When evening came, Jesus was there alone. And by this time, the boat was far out in the lake, tossed about by the waves, because the wind was blowing against it. Between 3 and 6 o'clock in the morning, Jesus came to the disciples walking on the water. When they saw him walking on the water, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and screamed with fear. Jesus spoke to them at once. "Courage," he said, "it is I. Don't be afraid." Then Peter spoke up. "Lord, if it is really you, order me to come out on the water to you." "Come," answered Jesus. So Peter got out his boat and started walking on the water to Jesus. But when he noticed the strong wind, he was afraid and started to sink down in the water. "Save me, Lord," he cried. At once Jesus reached out and grabbed hold of him and said, "How little faith you have. Why did you doubt?" They both got into the boat, and the wind died down. Then the disciples in the boat worshipped Jesus. "Truly, you are the Son of God," they exclaimed.
Debbie, thank you very much indeed. Well, we're just going to look at those two signs, and we have 2 points. The signs that speak of Jesus' sonship, and the son who seeks submission. And if you have your eyes on the homemade crumble, the first point is going to be slightly longer than the second, so don't panic. I've got my eyes on the homemade crumble, certainly, so we won't be. Now, the signs that speak of sonship, and I want us very simply to examine these two miracles, the feeding of the 5,000 families and the walking on water. I wonder if you can begin to imagine that scene of the feeding of the 5,000. Jesus had already withdrawn to a remote, solitary region, a lonely place, Matthew calls it. If you've ever been on holiday to the Mediterranean, you will be able to visualize it. I remember going on exercise up in northern Cyprus about 10 years ago now, way up in the hills above the sea with the clear blue sky and the beautiful spring temperature and the clear. It's absolutely, just to think of it in February is too much. And I remember, you know, occasionally if you've ever done that, you know, every now and then there will be a kind of tinkling in the distance, and then from nowhere a herd of goats would appear. Do you know that in the Mediterranean? It is extraordinary, isn't it? Followed by a goat herd whistling. Now somebody somehow got wind of where Jesus was. First one found him, then news began to spread. A small gathering becomes a crowd. Some came from the shores of the lake, still carrying their huge fishing baskets. Some at lunchtime, others as the school finished for the afternoon. Another little boy made it up with his picnic. Until eventually this remote desert region was swarming with people. The goat herds have brought their flocks. Why, even the traders had left their screens buzzing and flocked up into the hills. And verse 21 tells us there were 5,000 men alone, not counting women and children, which, when you put together the women and children, means there was probably a crowd of some, 20,000 people gathered listening to Jesus teach. The disciples are highly practical. Evening comes, and verse 15, it's already very late, they say. This is a lonely place. Send the people away. You can see them beginning to panic as tummies begin to rumble. And then Jesus gives this extraordinary reply in verse 16. You yourselves give them something to eat. They don't need to leave. What's he expecting them to do? I mean, whip out the mobile and call that pizza delivery? Or, I mean, it is an extraordinary answer, isn't it? They don't need to leave. You give them something to eat. And you can imagine the perplexity of the disciples. All we've got here are 5 loaves and 2 fish. And then Jesus takes center stage, verse 18. Bring them here. He orders the people to sit. He gives thanks, he breaks the loaves, and miraculously he feeds the 5,000, say 20,000 people. And 12 baskets representing the 12 tribes of Israel are gathered up. And that wonderful line, just in verse 21, Matthew was there, you see, Matthew verse 20, everyone ate and had enough. Who do you say Jesus is? What do we make of this sign? Let me tell you what some people have made of it. Some have argued that this is a kind of first communion service. The interpretation hangs on the way Jesus looks up to heaven and gives thanks. I think it's highly speculative. Apart from anything else, it is bread and fish that Jesus feeds them with. There's no mention of wine, and no indication whatsoever that this is to be repeated again and again and again. Others have taken a much more kind of 19th century sceptical line, and I'd love you to ask questions about this if you would like to. I was taught at theological college by a man who simply didn't believe that Jesus could do miracles. And therefore he believed that the miracles kind of grew in the telling, and that originally the little boy was there, and as he got out his picnic and started to offer round his Walker's crisps, he obviously hadn't seen the Gary Lineker advert, he offered them round, and as he broke the Kit Kat and handed the little bit, so everybody else was kind of inspired to get their own picnics out, and it was a vast sort of example in mutual sharing. Well, now, again, taking that seriously, it seems that that reading says more about the skepticism of my tutor than it does about the historical accuracy of the report. For it makes the people of Jesus' day out to be ignorant, gullible peasants, in extremely arrogant view, actually, that these people were just gullible peasants and they chased around after him in some kind of medieval frenzy. Why did thousands continue to come to him and proclaim him to be unique? If they knew perfectly well that afternoon they'd actually just got out their sandwiches wrapped up in a tin foil and shared them round. I mean, they're not ignorant peasants, are they? Now, there is a much more obvious and clear reading for the sign if we would stop to think about it, and I'd like to introduce you to it now. We haven't got time to go back to the Old Testament now, but there, if we did, I'd be able to take you to the occasion when God came to his people in the wilderness, in the lonely desert place, and fed them miraculously over 40 years. And he tells us there, back in the Old Testament, that the purpose of that miraculous feeding was deliberate. It was to show his people that he was with them, that they could trust him, and that he would bring them to his promised land. You can read all about it in the Old Testament book of Exodus, or you can get the video out from the library. What's it called? The Walt Disney video. Prince of Egypt, that's the chap, yes. And you can get a very hackneyed Disney version. Listen to what God says in the Old Testament. In the evening you will know that it was the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. In the morning you will see the glory of the Lord. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. And so for 14,600 days, this wandering people were taught this truth day after night after day after night after day after night, that God is with them, that he feeds them, that he shows his glorious presence as he miraculously provides for them. And every year after that 40 years, written into their calendar, like our Mothering Sunday and Remembrance Day and Christmas and Easter, they celebrated it. And then later in the Old Testament, God promises that he will come again in person to his people. He will feed them just as he did. He will provide for them and bring them to his promised land. Now, we haven't got time to go into that. And if we all had a Bible, I'd be able to show you the clear thrust of the Old Testament and those specific references. But with that background in place, then, you see, the miraculous feeding of the 5,000 families makes absolute sense. What is going on here? Why, Jesus is feeding God's people in the desert. That's why Matthew makes such a thing of the lonely place. It's literally the desert region. So who is this Jesus? Why, he is the long-promised Son of God, his king, come to be present with his people to lead them to his promised land, if only they will follow him. It is a sign that speaks of Jesus' sonship. And that's why, you know, these readings, we don't have to make up our own interpretation of the Bible, because the Bible tells us what the interpretation is, and it's there, over the page, page 38, verse 33. The disciples tell us the right response. They worship Jesus. Truly, you are the Son of God. I wonder, who would you say Jesus is this evening? Well, now on to the second sign, and verses 25 to 29, and the walking on water, where the point is exactly the same, the sign that speaks of sonship. Matthew tells us that the boat is many stadia out from the shore. A stadion is 185 metres, so we can safely assume that the boat is between 1.5, perhaps 2.5, 3 kilometres out from the shore. The wind is blowing, the waves are high, there is something of a storm at sea, and therefore it's not surprising, is it, verse 26, when the disciples see him walking on the water, they are terrified. Well, wouldn't you have been? It's a ghost, they said, and screamed with fear. Now, isn't that Matthew's in the boat, our eyewitness? Isn't that just a very realistic response? And then comes, by the way, my tutor said that there was a spit sticking out from the shore on the Lake of Galilee, and Jesus was actually shuffling along the spit, you know, the fact that it was 2 kilometre long spit, I don't think geographers amongst here will have ever come across a spit quite like that in the Sea of Galilee. And, you know, the disciples and Peter, of course, jumped onto the spit, and then he obviously fell off the spit when he started going in. But we can tackle that in the questions if you would like. I'd like to do that if you would enjoy doing that. But then comes this remarkable scene with Jesus and Peter, which, of course, the great artists, you know, if you go to the Uffizi, you see all these unintelligible Italian artists, have done it brilliantly, haven't they? These scenes of Peter as he gets out of the boat. Peter, notice Jesus' authority, courage, he said, literally, I am, that's God's name in the Bible. Verse 28, Lord, if it's you, order me to come out of the boat. Come, ordered Jesus. And Peter steps down. Can you picture that? You know, I come from Cornwall down in the southwest, and there's a lovely foot ferry that runs from Polruan, the little fishing village, across to Foy. Have you ever gone across on it? It's a lovely evening out, very romantic. You park your car up on the hill in Polruan and walk down and get onto the foot ferry, and then you go across the Foy harbour, still with all the lights and everything. And then you stop on the other side, and then there's that awful moment, isn't there, when you realise you have to get out of this boat onto the land, and you're so grateful for the sort of battered ancient mariner who has been on the foot ferry operating it for the last 480 years, as far as I can make out, who in a lovely gruff Cornish offers you his arm, and you're safe. Well, now, Peter got out of the boat. There was no sort of level. He got down out of the boat and started to walk. And then something catches his attention. He's distracted by the wind. He takes his eyes off Jesus. He starts to think, Lord, save me. And Jesus reaches out and rescues him. And then what happens? Isn't verse 31 quite extraordinary? Jesus gives him a rocket. How do you think Jesus said verse 31? Just look at it. Jesus reached out, grabbed hold of him and said, how little faith you have. Why did you doubt? The sign that speaks of sonship. Because, of course, again, the Old Testament over and over again shows God having absolute authority over the winds and the waves. And as we go back to the Old Testament, we find God promising that when he sends his Son to this earth, he will be with his people as they pass through the water. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. When you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you, for I am the Lord, your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Saviour. What does Jesus do? He comes, walking on the water. The disciples are terrified. They think they see a ghost. Take courage. I am. And then Peter comes to him on the water, and then he rescues him. Now you see, these two historical incidents alone, with their Old Testament background, point, it seems to me, unambiguously to Jesus Christ as God's King, God's Son. They are signs that speak of sonship. God himself as ruler, stepping down to our little planet on the suburbs of the universe to call his people, to draw them to God. And then, therefore, if they are signs that speak of sonship, then the application, it seems to me, is obvious. And again, we don't need the brains of an archbishop to work out the application, because it's given to us there in verse 33. See, the Bible always tells us what our right response should be to the truth that it teaches. The disciples in the boat worshipped Jesus. Truly, you are the Son of God. Let me ask you, what about you? Who do you say Jesus is? Interesting but irrelevant? Impotent, innocuous, but strangely soothing and comforting, a fashion accessory, a hobby, you know, some are into curling, others do skeleton rides, Some like bridge, I'm into golf, but Christians are into Jesus. Who do you say Jesus is? The Son. Signs speak of sonship. The Son seeks submission. They worshipped him. You know, that word worship is a very simple one. It literally means to bow down. Actually, it comes from two words meaning to kiss, towards, not in an erotic way, but in a submissive way. And the idea is that when one comes into the presence of a being or a person of infinitely greater and more powerful than oneself, then one bows down. One kisses the ground towards the person, expressing total and absolute submission and surrender in every area of life, not just for 1 hour on a Sunday, but of everything. It's a submission word describing a whole life handed over to one who is far greater than myself to serve him. Almost 8 years ago now, a couple here in St. Helens got married, and they, in fact, quite a few did, to tell you the truth. And they decided, however, to go away from the wedding in an ancient litter. James built it out of an old bed and some old boards, and let me tell you, it weighed a ton. Some of you will remember this great event. They were carried by their ushers on a Saturday night from the church, actually over in St. Andrews, down Bishopsgate to Liverpool Street, where they were going to head up the East Coast for their honeymoon. James in his tails, Elizabeth in her white dress, the ushers in their tails, carrying the litter and the wedding party behind. And as they approached the station, the Saturday evening train from Norwich pulled in, upon which were 200 to 300 Tottenham Hotspur fans who had travelled up to Norwich for the match that afternoon and now were returning suitably refreshed from their afternoon out. As I say, James was in his tailcoat, Elizabeth was in her white dress, the rest of the wedding party were still following in hats, tails and champagne glasses and confetti. And it was one of those, you know, one of those epic moments of life when two cultures meet, and there's just this sort of, there's this deathly pause, and you say to yourself, what is going to happen next? To a man and a woman, the Tottenham Hotspur fans, when they saw the litter come round the corner, got down on the platform on their hands and knees and bowed down like this and chanted, "We are not worthy, we are not worthy," until James and Elizabeth had passed and they were safely ensconced on the train. That is to kiss towards. It's what you do in the presence of supreme sovereign authority. Abraham does it as God visits him. Joseph's brothers do it in the presence of one unimaginably greater than themselves. The Israelites do it as God appears to them. Moses does it in the presence of God. What about you? You see, it's an act speaking symbolically of a whole life lived out in reverence, respect, service, and submission to God's rightful King and ruler, Jesus Christ. The disciples in the boat worship Jesus. Truly, you are the Son of God. The signs speak of sonship, and the Son, of course. What seeks? No, demands. Surrender, submission, service, worship. Let me ask you, who do you say he is? Do you see why all of these adjectives that we've mentioned so far are actually so deeply objectionable to God? In fact, they are thoroughly offensive to God. Interesting but irrelevant. Of God, our Creator, when he visits us. Impotent, innocuous but strangely soothing. of the one who made me and owns me and loves me? A fashion accessory, a bit of a hobby? How deeply offensive to God if he has come to our tiny little planet somewhere in the suburbs of the Milky Way. For if he is God's one and only Son, his King, then there is only one right response: submission. This last week I read Jonathan Aitken's biography. It's a fascinating biography, and it's worth a read, actually. And he has this brilliant description of his attitude to God before he became a Christian. At that time, my attitude was not unlike my relationship with my bank manager, for I spoke to him politely, visited his premises intermittently, occasionally asked him for a small favour or overdraft to get myself out of difficulty, thanked him condescendingly for his assistance, kept up the appearance of being one of his reasonably reliable customers, and maintained superficial contact with him on the grounds that one of these days he might come in useful. Well, now, in the face of Jesus Christ, that sort of response to God is, well, it's inadequate. The Son demands submission. Well, now, we've finished with our time. It's time for pudding. May I encourage you to take those blue question slips? I'd love you to fill out any questions you would like. It would be useful to have a good question time, so please feel free to write out questions. Over pudding, why not think about this Christianity Explored? I mean, we've just spent 25 minutes talking about Jesus. This Christianity Explored course runs over 7 weeks. It's similar to this evening, without quite the same sort of high class, this, that, and the other, but it is a really good evening, and you might like to pick that up and think about it. We'll resume again in about 20 minutes. Thank you.
Well, thank you for some great questions. We have a heap of questions. All of them are worthwhile questions, and we wish we had time to deal with each of them in the detail that they demand. Unfortunately, we don't have that kind of time, so we've tried to select a representative sample of the questions to deal with the questions which kept coming up from the various tables, and we'll try and work through some of those for us. If your question wasn't answered, and you feel that you can't leave here tonight until it is answered, then do feel free to come to the front at the end and talk to William or myself, and we'll try our best to give you some kind of answer to your question. William, here's the first question. Why did you choose to base your talk on those two signs stroke miracles this evening?
Thank you. That is a very good question indeed. Obviously, it is something that I've thought about. Matthew organizes his material very, very carefully into major sections, and each of the major sections has a major theme. He's a very careful author. You know, the myth goes around that the first century writers were just kind of ignorant peasants who strung together a few ideas. Interestingly, our section is organized into four panels, like panels on a shutter, and each panel has two parts. One is the challenge that Jesus lays down, and the next is the evidence to back the challenge, and then there's another challenge, then there's more evidence, then there's another challenge, then there's more evidence, and then Jesus says, now what about you, who do you say that I am? And so that just gives you a feel for the literature. It's very, very carefully put together and structured. Matthew's gospel, I think, is a gospel for our generation. I use that broadly, that term, our generation. I started teaching Matthew's gospel about 3 years ago when I started working here at St. Helens. And some people said, you're absolutely mad, because Matthew is the Jewish gospel. And that was precisely the reason why I started teaching Matthew's gospel, because Matthew draws very, very heavily indeed on the Old Testament. And it seems to me that our culture, our generation, having cut off ourselves from God the Creator, no longer have any sense of God operating a grand, connected plan over centuries and millennia. And you know, our generation, I think Major Tom sums up our generation. Here am I, sitting on a tin can, planet Earth is blue, there's nothing. So what is it, how does it go? But you know what I mean, sort of floating about, cut off from the Creator, not knowing where we're going, with no sense of connectedness Personally, historically, I think our culture is a disconnected culture. I could speak to you for an hour about that. And you can see evidence of it everywhere. Everywhere you look, disconnectedness. Now, you see, that is why Matthew's is the gospel. Just take your Matthew's gospel and look at how it begins. Just pick it up and turn to page 2. Matthew begins with Jesus' family tree. And it traces Jesus' family tree all the way back to Abraham to show us that God has had a plan, a purpose, a design for his world. Not just, Jesus was more than a sort of flash in the pan magician. One or two people asked, was Jesus just a magician? He wasn't just a flash in the pan magician. No, God had planned the arrival of Jesus for centuries and millennia before he came, from the beginning of time. And everywhere you cut open scripture, like a stick of rock, you can see God's, you can see God's plan and purpose tracing through. And for a disconnected culture like ours to be connected back in to the eternal purpose of God seems to me very important. And I chose these two signs because of their connectedness to God's eternal plan. He promised to come and miraculously feed his people, and he did. Yes, go on, sorry.
I was going to say, can I guillotine you?
Yes, please do.
Because we've got quite a few to get through. That was the next question is you can help William with his David Bowie quotes as well, he'd be really really pleased at the end of the evening. This question came up a lot, and it's a crucial question. William, how can Jesus be God and the Son of God? Did he ever claim to be either? Is there a chance he was a prophet of God?
Thank you very much. Can I draw the distinction, please, between God the Son and the Son of God? This is a slightly technical, theological distinction, but it's very important when we're reading Matthew's Gospel. The Son of God is a title for God's King. So in the Psalms, in fact, all the way through, from the moment God promises to send his King, he refers to him as the Son of God. God's King is described as being divine. So the Son of God is a title of divinity, of godness, of being God. So when the disciples exclaim, truly, this is the Son of God, they're not just saying, oh, he's a Son of God. They're saying, this is the Son of God, God's long-promised King, the Messiah, the Anointed One. The one who will judge everybody at the end of time and wrap up our universe. The one to whom everybody is answerable. Elsewhere, you see Jesus talking about himself as God the Son. That is, the one who is eternally God, the second person of the Trinity. And you'll see John's Gospel speaks a lot about God the Son. But they're two slightly distinct phrases. Actually, the Son of God is divine. So, the Son of God is God the Son. But that explains why there's that discussion. And some people say, oh, well, because it says he's the Son of God, it can't mean that he's God. No, because the Son of God, the Christ, the Messiah, the King, is divine. And he is the one to whom Psalm 2 says, the nations, the kings, the rulers, Bill Clinton, Bush, George W., Tony Blair, will bow the knee one day in judgment. And you will, and I will. As we meet him, whether we like it or not.
This is a related question in many ways. At the time, how was Jesus viewed by other people? I.e., the disciples believed he was the Son. Was this the general consensus?
Yeah, thanks very much. There was a lot of offence. It's very interesting, isn't it? You know, we sometimes think, oh, well, Jesus was a nice bloke, you know, and everybody liked him. No, people found him deeply offensive. Some recognised his claims. Interestingly, nobody denied that he was doing these miraculous signs. So just again, turn, if you would, to chapter 13. And it's very interesting. Here are his own family. Page 36. Page 36. And right at the bottom there, verse 53. When Jesus finished telling these parables, he left that place and went back to his hometown. He taught in the synagogue, and those who heard him were amazed. Where did he get such wisdom, they asked, and what about his miracles? And then verse 56, where did he get all this? and so they rejected him. So in our section, that's panel A, part one, immediately rejection. Herod, very next few verses, rejects Jesus. Just turn back a page and look at his enemies. Turn back to two or three pages to chapter 9. This is a very interesting reference. Chapter 9, verse 34, page 23. The Pharisees, these are his enemies, said, "It is the chief of the demons who gives Jesus the power to drive out demons." So how was he perceived by the people of his time? Well, those who were prepared to submit their lives to his authority recognized him as God. Interestingly, nobody denied that he was doing these things. The people who knew him best, his townspeople, were saying, "Where did he get the power?" Those who wanted to reject him said, "The power must come from the devil." But nobody could deny that he was doing the miracles, which makes the 18th century skeptics' case, I think, very, very suspect. How can we, 1800 years later, come along and suddenly say, given that his greatest enemies acknowledged that he did the miracles, how can we suddenly say, "Well, of course he didn't, you know. They were just deceived." No, his enemies saw that he was doing the miracles and said, either he's the devil or he's God. We reckon he's the devil. And actually, those are the only two options open to you tonight. I hope you leave here either saying, I hope you never, ever leave here saying Jesus is the devil, but it is the only option available to you if he's not God. If he's not doing God's work, he must be on the other side.
William, this one picks up again on miracles. Why have there been no miracles in this day and age, when there is now a community that's better educated to critically examine them?
Yes, thank you. I'm going to talk about this on Sunday morning, so I only want to speak very briefly about this. You see, we mustn't think that, he says, we mustn't think that the miracles are kind of sort of Gandalf specials, dazzling displays of divine fireworks, designed to sort of spectacularize and bulldoze us into belief. Now, I hope I've shown that the miracles are direct fulfillments of the Old Testament. So God has promised for thousands of years that he will send his Son. His Son comes and behaves as God says he will. There is no need for any more miracles, because he's done the miracles. And Jesus crits the crowds, and we'll tackle this on Sunday morning, because the crowds simply stand there saying, "Show us another miracle, show us another miracle, show us another miracle. I'm not going to look, I won't listen." They won't actually look at the signs of the times. They just stick their fingers in their ears and say, "Give me another miracle." They've got a kind of miracle addiction. And Jesus says, actually, you don't need more miracles. You need to think about the miracles I have done. And think about them. Get your brain working and see, well, who do you really think he is?
I think it's interesting too, isn't it, that the level of miracle that's claimed doesn't need a scientifically critical age to accredit it. In any age, if somebody is dead and you see them alive the next moment, you're able to assess what's going on. It's not at the level of, "I had a sore throat" or "I had a bad back and now it's better." It's at the level of withered arms being made whole and the level of dead people living. So, in a sense, whichever age it happens in, you're able to assess what's gone on.
Fantastic, thank you. That answers a lot of the questions about the nature of the material. And it is historical. It's not just man's views of God, this material. It is historical data. Eyewitnesses write as eyewitnesses. They're writing history for us.
Can we pick that up? Because that's where the next... It sounds terribly slick, this, doesn't it? But to be honest...
Richard and Judy.
We haven't a... We didn't have...
I'm Richard.
And my shirt is done up, so we're okay.
So you can't be... We won't go down that track.
We didn't have enough time to make it...
Richard and Judy. People always talk about Richard and Judy. I haven't got a clue who they are. Do you know, Andrew?
I'm never out of bed in that time in the morning. Right. But no, they're afternoons now, aren't they? They've kind of moved on the mornings.
Yes.
William, a lot of questions along these lines. How can we be sure Matthew's account is reliable, that he was really an eyewitness?
Yeah. I would love you to come and really examine this on the Christianity Explored course. The evidence for the historical reliability of the eyewitness accounts is vast. There is a book at the back there called The Case for Christ, written by an ex-Chicago legal journalist, editor of the Herald Tribune, legal editor of the Herald Tribune or something, Lee Strobel. And the first sort of 100 pages or so is all devoted to the evidence for the historical reliability of Scripture. I'd love you to take it and read it. Here it is, look. And it's yours for a fiver. In fact, if you're here as a visitor tonight, the person who brought you will buy it for you. There you go. That's nice. That's excellent. Okay, so just for a fiver, take it away. If you can stomach the kind of, you know, I looked into his wizened face as he answered this question and all that sort of stuff, there's a certain amount of that. It's written by a journalist. It's absolutely brilliant. It is really, really good. There are two questions, really, around which all of this hangs. Is what we've got what they wrote? That's a transmission question. Is what they wrote what actually happened? That's an issue of reliability. And several of the questions mentioned the time gap between the events and the recording. Actually, I think the destruction of Jerusalem in 69 AD and its non-mention in the Gospels suggests that, and most scholars would be happy with this, I think, that the material was basically written by 69 AD. That is actually a very small gap between 33 and 69, given that in that period, the accounts in a non-literary society were being orally transmitted over and over and over and over again. So it wasn't that there was a 30-year gap and then somebody sat down in their study and started scratching their head, and now what did happen when he fed the 5,000? You see? No, Matthew had told this story. I was there. You know, and there were 12 baskets, and there was more than enough. And everybody ate enough, and then he told it, and people were there, and they checked his account. So it wasn't as if there was a great time lag, and then people said, no, it was being preached and taught day after day after day around the world. And there was an editorial process that went on with some of the material that was written in that, in that 30, 40 years, whereby that material was described, shelved because it was made up. I could show you the Gospel of Thomas that never made it into the New Testament because it was so clearly made up. And the people who saw what Jesus did said, no, this is a hoax. It's not true. So they didn't include it. So what was true was kept in, and there was an editorial process that went on. There is so much I could say on that. Do you want another 2 minutes?
30 seconds. Or should we move on?
The other thing which we were brought up on, and I don't know whether this knocks around at all these days, was, oh, well, Matthew, Mark and Luke colluded. And they colluded round a pre-existent document, which people called Q, no relation to the bloke in James Bond. And that was always put out to us by the sceptics. Now, it is true that they seem to have drawn on a similar source. But the very fact that they drew on a similar source means that there was material in existence pre-Matthew, Mark and Luke. That forces back the eyewitness material to even closer to the event. I wish I'd been shrewd enough to have said that to the person who taught me when I was 18, all this sort of stuff. Because he was saying, oh, well, of course, you know, but of course, yeah, but if there was some pre-written material from before Matthew, Mark and Luke, and say they were written in the late 50s, 60s, something like that, then there was stuff dating back from before that, which they drew on. So this huge, great time gap, I don't think it washes. Quite apart from anything else, the disciples didn't have anything to gain from making it up, because they were fed to the lions, used as torches by Nero in his garden, soaked in tar and set alight. You know, there wasn't much incentive.
Let's change course a little bit.
Great.
This is a huge question. Are not all religions the same? So does it matter how we worship God by whatever name?
Yes, thank you. Thanks. That's a very, very good question. I did an assembly at my little girls' school the other day. And my purpose of the assembly, without taking a Christian line, was to undermine the folly of our age that all religions are basically the same. And I think an 8-year-old can see through that. That all religions cannot possibly be equally true. because all religions say totally different things. And I said to the 8-year-olds, you know, imagine I had a great aunt Gertrude, which they thought was hysterically funny, I don't quite know why. Who here thinks my great aunt Gertrude is tall? And some of them put their hands up. Who thinks my great aunt Gertrude is small? And some put their hands up. Who thinks my great aunt Gertrude is somewhere in the middle? And who thinks that I don't have a great aunt Gertrude at all? So we had 4 groups, and we had a representative of each at the front. What would you say if I said that all 4 groups were equally true? And they said, I would think you were an idiot. The 8-year-olds.
Perceptive.
Which, well, I love 8-year-olds. And I said, you know, I love 8-year-olds, don't you? Because there's none of the sort of baloney that you hear from anybody else. So, say they said, you're an idiot, because either she's one or she's the other. She can't be. And if one is saying one thing categorically different to the other, then one of them, they cannot all be right. So then we started to think, and I said, you know, your rabbi would say this to you, so would your imam, so should your Christian leader, and so would the Hindu priest. And I said, you know, you see, the Buddhists, for example, Buddhism, as you know, is an atheistic religion. They don't believe there is a god, essentially. The Hindus believe there are millions of different gods. Islam, Muslims and Jews would believe that there is just one god. They would think it's absolutely appalling to suggest that the God exists in 3 persons, which is why they stoned Jesus and eventually crucified him. Now, they are categorically saying totally different things. And it is actually the arrogance and folly of the 21st century that we can say, oh, well, actually, poor things, they're all so ignorant that they really don't know what they're saying, and they're all saying the same thing, dear things. I mean, that is the height of arrogance. Actually, it's a different religion. It's another religion that is being created. And the trouble with that religion, of course, is that I take the little bits that I like, and I don't have to submit to anybody. So I create my own designer God who suits me. And do you know what the Bible calls that? Idolatry. It is the great wickedness of our age, isn't it? We don't want to bow to anybody. We want to run our own lives our own way. God has shown himself on this earth. And we say, oh, well, I'll only take the bits I like. And I will redesign him in my own image. And then I'll worship myself.
William, our time's gone, and there are lots of good questions that we've had to leave, but just one final question, because again, it was at the heart of what you said. What does it mean to submit to Jesus?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. Who is it that says a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step? Apart from Schmir, who was it that said it? Was it someone like German Mao? But to submit to Jesus is an entire lifelong journey. I mean, I'm discovering areas now. I'm past that magic age of 30, 40, of submission, you know, that I never realized that God would want me to submit in and to say, Lord, I will serve you here and there. And yes, I realize that it is your best plan for me to serve you in this way. But it begins with a single step, and it begins with saying, I recognize, Jesus, that you are wonderful, that you are good, that you are pure, that you are perfect, that you made me, that you love me. I mean, just in that story, remember the compassion for the crowd? He took pity on them. Remember Peter drowning, Lord, save me. He reached out to save him. It begins with recognizing Jesus for who he is, our loving creator, and saying, well, Lord, I would like you to be Lord over me. And who knows what areas of my life it's going to affect? Well, let me tell you everything. But only for your good. Let me tell you, you will find worshipping Jesus rather than an idol of your own making liberating, life-enhancing in every area of life. Idols of our own making just tie us up in knots. They leave us nowhere. We chase after wealth and all these other things, and we end up nowhere. When we follow Jesus, we find he takes us to heaven. And on the way, he shows us how to live on earth. But it begins with that single step. And you may like to take that step this evening as you go home. You know, kneel by your bed and say, Lord, I bow to you. And now show me. And then tomorrow, begin to find out how to please him. Start to read Matthew's gospel. Come and do Christianity Explored. Get to know him. Discover the person Jesus. And then watch him revolutionize your life.
William, thank you. Thank you for talking to us. And thank you for your answers. Let me just take a couple of minutes to wrap the evening up, to thank you once again for coming. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your attentiveness. Thank you for your many great questions. And if you are interested in following things up, let me just point out a few ways of doing that. First of all, the Matthew's Gospels that are on your table are quite free. You're very welcome to take them away with you. And please do read them. I think it takes about 2 to 3 hours to read Matthew's Gospels, so it's 10 minutes or so before you go to sleep each night, and you'd be through it very, very quickly. Also, as William mentioned in his talk, we run a course for 7 weeks, 7 evenings a week, called Christianity Explored. It's there on the yellow card. It's an opportunity to carry on asking questions, to hear more about the Christian faith, and to discuss it with others who are interested in finding out more too. There are no questions barred. So do take the details for Christianity Explored. If it's something you think you'd like to do, you can fill out the card this evening and drop it in the bin by the doors as you leave. Or else, if you want a chance to think about it a little bit, then get in touch with our church office if you decide that you'd like to do it. William mentioned that there are a variety of books available at the door. He mentioned one to you. Let me mention just a couple of others. There is a book called Jesus Among Other Gods by a man called Ravi Zacharias, who works out of Oxford. It's particularly helpful if you were thinking through that issue of other religions, but it takes in very many other issues too. That's available at the door. There is also this glossy magazine format called More to Life. I think it says £1.50, but if money's really a problem, you are very welcome to take it away with you, and it boils down the Christian faith in a very easily to read format. If reading's not your thing and you'd rather listen, I feel like a door-to-door carpet salesman at the moment. One of these, buy this Dyson and it will revolutionize your life. We have a variety of tapes which you might find helpful. We have a tape of the first talk in this week of talks, which was given on Sunday night. Do take that away with you. The red tape is called The Arrogance of Christianity. People will often say Christians are arrogant to say that Jesus Christ is the only way to God. If that's a question you've got, this red one might be a good place to start. The green tape is William, again, on Christianity Explored, a basic introduction to the Christian faith. And then a yellow tape, which answers the questions, why bother with Christianity, and is Christianity a crutch? All those tapes are free. If you keep coming back every night, you can get a free tape of the previous night's talk as well. We're keen that you should be able to take these away with you, so please do, if you so choose to do so.